pricing is very interesting because it's far more psychological than it is economic. It's far more about how people feel about products than how much they can afford or what the actual value is.
You're listening to the Yo Podcast with Rob Hope.
John Anolin is the founder of Ghost, a profitable not-for-profit business that gives away their code for free. How? On the one side is Ghost, the open source publishing software. On the other is the same platform run as a premium hosted SaaS business. John and I rap about remote working, pricing, competition, and building a future platform to help journalists monetize their craft. Yo, John, welcome to the Yo Studio.
Thanks for having me.
So I've decided I'm not going to ask you about Ghost beginnings.
Oh, sick.
I listen to a few podcasts and no one has done it better than Cortland.
Yeah.
From Indie Hackers. So I'm going to link that below. Cool. So why are you in Cape Town?
good question. I don't know. I tend to come here a few months every summer, or at least have done for the last few years.
Yeah.
Obviously live and work remotely, so I can be anywhere. And this time of year, Cape Town's one of the better places in the world, I think, you can hang out.
And do you feel 3 months is a good window to actually experience a city or country, you'd say?
I think, let's say geographic region. So I'll cop out and choose somewhere in between the two, like an area,
yeah.
3 months. So if I go somewhere, 3 months is like pretty good. That's what I aim for. If I can do 3 months, that's pretty good.
And you've sort of acclimatized fully by that point, eh?
Yeah, yeah. So it's enough time where you can get good deals on apartments, so you're not like Airbnb stuck on some extortionate rate, which you would be if you're just staying somewhere a week. And it's not so long that kind of visas start getting problematic. So it's just long enough where you can really kind of embed yourself in a local area, live like a local, figure out where the good food spots are, what people who actually live in a place do, not what tourists do.
You know, remote working obviously is getting more popular.
Yes.
Give me three, you know, obstacles you get when you start remote working that people aren't really aware of. You know, they think they need a laptop.
Let's see. Things that are probably more unexpected or I guess surprise people in particular are a lot of people have a notion of utopia, which when you say a utopian idea about anything in life, usually it's unrealistic, right? But for some reason, remote work is consistently pitched as, you know, take a laptop to a beach, travel anywhere you want, live whatever lifestyle you want. And in reality, it should be obvious, but it isn't. There are trade-offs. Some of those trade-offs are obvious, like you don't see family and friends, which you might already have. Of course, you make new friends, but they tend to be more transient. So you'll meet someone for a few months and never see them again, which for the most part is kind of your new normal. And the other thing is it doesn't solve all problems. So you may be in Bali where it's lovely temperature and the sun is shining and you have your own swimming pool for a fraction of the cost of your previous life. But the rest of your problems are still there. If you're fat to start with, you're still fat. If you're depressed to start with, you're probably still going to be depressed. Like, you don't solve your internal problems just by changing your external surroundings. And I think that's a big challenge for a lot of people to overcome when they start out doing a remote or nomad lifestyle, or even just moving to a new place, having not done it before.
Okay, so from, you know, from a traveling point of view and, you know, packing gear and so on.
Yeah.
You know, you live out of suitcase pretty much.
Yeah.
Do you ever have, you know, undercarriage luggage?
Yeah, nowadays. First 6.5 years or so, I was just carry on.
I mean, not to have a stab at, you know, the industry, but I love it how people try and go ultra minimalist. I can go anywhere in the world with a backpack, but you know, you're allowed undercarriage and it's practical. Obviously, if you're bouncing Europe on cheap flights.
Well, not only that, but so the first year or two, I had a backpack, right? And that's what gets promoted, like, oh, you travel, you need a backpack, not these heavy roll-on cases. And then, so the first year I did that, year and a half or something, and then you figure out like, oh, I'm not a backpacker. This is bullshit. I'm carrying this fucking bag around the whole time. And the only places I go are like paved streets, paved airports.
Yes.
And the only time I use my suitcase is like once every 3 months.
Yeah, use a fucking like, wheelie
just
bag.
Just get the goddamn wheels. It's so much easier and so much more comfortable. And you can, I don't know, it's easier to fit in the back of bags, back of taxis and stuff without worrying about it getting crushed. And then, yeah, nowadays I have a check-in case as well, because in reality, if you're moving slow every 2-3 months, it's really not a problem. Like,
hey, this is AJ from Yo Podcast Number One. If you're tired of listening to John, which, you know, that's to be expected, don't forget that I was also in the first episode of this podcast, so feel free to click on over to that and hear what I have to say, which is probably a bit more interesting than what John has to say. Back to you, Rob.
Very rude.
It's super rude, eh? You know, you've mentioned in the past that you've tried a few, you know, minor marketing efforts with Ghost. They haven't really worked out.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, thinking of AJ, how that guy, you know, builds for 99% of the time, drops one tweet, and that's his marketing. Okay. He's an anomaly.
Yeah.
Okay. But when does a business actually justify taking, you know, that development fund and allocating it? Like, when do you greenlight that point?
So that's an interesting one, because I think we passed that point recently. So it's quite fresh in my mind. We've also historically just built stuff, shipped it, done a blog post and a tweet. And essentially all of our growth has been word of mouth. We've never done any paid marketing. We've been very light on any SEO or even content marketing. Kind of ironic for a publishing platform. But we've grown completely through just recommendations of people who already use the platform and tweeting to our existing community. Recently, we made our first marketing hire about 6 months ago, with an eye to probably bring on a second person towards the end of this year. And the inflection point really, or the change was when product teams started shipping so much that there was no longer enough time to talk about all the things that it could do.
Oh, I understand.
So, for example, we shipped 2 new APIs, and so you've got documentation, then you've got kind of integration and examples of integrations with an API. And then there's all kinds of other stuff you can do, like different kinds of sites or project or widget or app or thing you could build with the API, right?
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense to do like a video series talking about that, or multiple tutorial blog posts explaining that, or integrations with partners where you show how Ghost and Zapier work together to kind of deliver other functionalities different places. But who's going to do all that?
Yeah, totally.
And so if you're shipping stuff and it does lots of things, but there's no one talking about it because you haven't got enough time to say all the things that need to be said about it, that's where it starts to become obvious, like, oh, we've invested X amount of development hours into doing this. It would be crazy if we didn't tell people how it actually works.
Yeah, it's like wasted promotion opportunity.
Yeah. Or even beyond promotion, like, forget finding new users. Just how are existing users supposed to know how to use the new thing you just shipped? So we think a lot more about marketing in terms of promoting ways to use the products to new and existing users who have already discovered it, rather than trying to find more users. Middle of the funnel, I guess, would be the marketing slang for that.
Middle of the funnel. Yeah. Cool. Okay, so Ghost is the black sheep. It's a profitable, not-for-profit company that releases software for free with no copyright, okay?
Yep.
Do you think this business model is not utilized enough in other industries? I was trying to do my research on just like, you know, different software, for example, email support software, you know, that's often open source and they have, you know, kind of hosted options. But, you know, you guys have done it better than them, it seems. Are people not doing it right? Are they?
I don't know about better. I think we probably give off, I think every company, I've said this before somewhere, I think, but every company gives off the best version of itself, right? Like every company website is like every person's Instagram feed. It's the best bits. It's the highlights. And you don't see the ugly behind the scenes of what's really going on in order to make that lifestyle possible. So there's famously a dark side to everything that looks beautiful. Yeah. And in our case, you know, having a very popular open source project, profitable nonprofit organization, a remote team, and a business that appears to be working pretty well. There's a lot that goes into that. There's a disproportionate amount of work that goes into that. The amount of work required to get to where we've gotten with the size of team we've gotten probably at certain points has demanded unhealthy amounts of time and investment from various people and hasn't always been sustainable. And it's not, if I was starting over again today, I don't know how many different industries our model could be replicated in. I think we hit a really good inflection point of timing, of the market, of demand, of new technologies emerging, a couple of people around at the right time, the earliest points. to get it going. And while I love open source, there are a lot of parts of it which are unrealistically difficult. So I think it's very difficult. And what we have is definitely not a silver bullet or a perfect recipe that's repeatable. I think there are parts of it that are very good, and there are parts of it which could use a lot of work.
So dude, we're going to transition into the section I like to call true, false, or maybe. You just got to give either of those three words, eh?
Maybe.
There's no such thing as too many tattoos.
Oh, definitely true.
A misspelt tattoo is the fault of the client, not the artist.
Couldn't go both ways. I once heard a story of I think it was a Manchester fan, and the guy wanted a Leeds tattoo. He didn't get a Leeds tattoo. So I think it can go both ways.
Mauritius is the most beautiful place in the world.
Maybe.
No joke that starts with a ghost, a WordPress, and a medium walk into a bar is going to end well.
True.
If Automattic offered you any job role for $1 million a year, you wouldn't take it.
Absolutely not.
So true. Last question. You suffer from aphantasia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, which I only discovered recently.
Tell us about that.
So aphantasia is a condition or an affliction whereby the mind has no ability to create any sort of visual imagery of whatsoever. So easy way to explain this, there's two ways. One is if I close my eyes and imagine something, I don't see anything. I see nothing. I see black. I see the back of my eyelids. And so obviously I've grown up thinking that was normal my whole life. But I discovered, I don't know, when I was about 14, 15, that apparently other people imagine stuff and they can either kind of sort of imagine it and see it in the real world, like I'm holding an imaginary cup on this table right now, and they can sort of picture it, like literally with their eyes picture it. And when they close their eyes and think of a rainforest, they can see leaves and really kind of be there, almost like a dream-ish state. I don't have that. It's just black.
It's wild.
Nothing. No visual anything. If I think of a song, apparently a lot of people, they hear a track, like they hear a beat.
So it goes the same with audio?
Yeah, same with audio. So if you think of the intro to Michael Jackson, Billie Jean.
Yeah, I can hear it.
I can't. I know what it is. I know logically the words that go with it, the rhythm of the percussion, and I can hum it and I can sing it.
I say when it comes to music, your memory, you know, you hum it in rhythm and it's all there in your head already. So yours would have to be pure
sequence. So mine's, it's like I'm looking up a database entry and I can comprehend the data, but I can't pass it.
Wow. Yeah. So I mean, this leads pretty good into my next one. So I try and keep things objective on the show, and I must admit, I think you're quite an underrated designer. So we're just gonna we're gonna leave that one. That's the only compliment of the show. I would imagine designing would be quite difficult with this symptom.
Yeah. You would think. I don't really understand that either.
So you envision a shape, and then you know, you'd sort of draw it. But same with colors, same with music. I just feel there would be an influence.
So I studied music. Music's a great passion, but I'm not very good at music. I studied music for a long time, and my greatest frustration was, like any kind of creative outlet, you get to a point where you have taste, but you don't have skills. So you can recognize something that's good, but you are unable to reproduce it.
Yes.
And if the thing that you're doing is something you're good at, then that changes. And eventually you sort of recognize through your own tastes that the work you're producing is good. And in my case with music, I never got to that point. I could never reach any point.
It was never
point.
Satisfying.
No, it was never satisfying. It's immensely frustrating. With design, I could get there.
Yes.
I'm not the most creative designer. I think my skill in a lot of areas, or the thing that I'm good at and pride myself on, is taking existing ideas, concepts, designs, and re-blending them, remeshing, coming up with new things.
Refining them a little.
Yeah. There's a great documentary by Kirby Ferguson called Everything's a Remix, which is kind of all about this concept of ideas being rehashed and reinvented and recombined and turned into new things over and over and over again. And I enjoyed that a lot. That's what works for me. But coming up with kind of brand new blank canvas things, not so much.
How much of an influence do you think, you know, your design skills brought into Ghost, you know, influence where it is now? Because I feel that blog post, you know, led to the Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
You know, you really influenced that campaign with your design again. And the Ghost site now is, you know, it's it's beautiful. Obviously, you know, it's not a game changer if a platform website's that beautiful.
Yeah.
I.e. WordPress. But I mean, I feel that, you know, Ghost is in a better place because you brought design in as a founder.
So I think design has always been one of the things we focused on as a differentiator for Ghost.
Yes.
Speed, efficiency, design, care for the products has been a differentiator, particularly versus other open source products, which tend to be have either no designers or so few designers or so little care for design, that's quite a big contrast. So I think that definitely helped, and it was definitely an element. But the way we approach product design now and how I've always approached product design is the visuals is maybe 20% of it, or the aesthetics, and the UI is maybe 20% of it. But yes. Design to us has always meant a planned experience, and that can be everything. We spent, I don't know how many hours, designing CLI error messages and the color coding and the wording and the components finesse. And the patterns, so that if you're installing as a developer Ghost via CLI, it's a good experience. Mm. If an error happens, then we have a pattern which says what happened, what the probable cause was, and what the next step is that you should do. And that's a pattern.
It feels like it's from your system and not actually a third-party plugin error message.
Exactly. And that's kind of repeated everywhere. And it's the same reason why Stripe is loved by developers, because that whole experience of working with the API is designed. It's not random. It's not a JSON object that's thrown together. It's been designed to be great to work with. And design in that sense means just planned, conceived, predicted, created with some intent, with empathy and care for how the person using it is going to experience it. And that's probably the single biggest thing that's filtered into from the Kickstarter days to now is demonstrating that we've thought of the big picture, all the details, not just one particular glossy UI.
I mean, is this statement fair, that saying when you arrive at a website and it's got beautiful design, you immediately think that they care about their product and they care about me as a customer?
I think so. I think that's probably less true now than it was, because good design, good...
Because you can just hire good designers.
And good aesthetic design has become a commodity with Squarespace and...
But it would influence the initial sign-up.
Yeah, to some extent, yeah.
Hey, this is Jess Eddy. You best hit that subscribe button, as I'm coming up in Yo! Podcast Episode 3.
So you got your hosted platform, entry-level pricing, $29 a month.
Yep.
Okay, so I want to know, you know, how did it land up there? I mean, you can go as deep as you want, but why is it not $9 and why is it not $19?
Good question. One of my favorite subjects, actually, because anyone who's created anything, made anything, and shipped it, almost without exception, has undercharged consistently, always, even now.
Every time.
We have a friend called Mark, who's launching amazing... he has launched an amazing app called Thought Train. He's about to launch Thought Train 2.
Version 2.
Exactly. And he's pricing it $6 a month. And I keep telling him it's too low. I keep trying to get him to raise it, because we start at $5 a month. And what you find with the lower price points is you get lower quality customers who have higher support demands. They have less invested in the product, less care, less... a lot less finesse about how they're going to go about using it. It's just a throwaway. And pricing is very interesting, because it's far more psychological than it is economic. It's far more about how people feel about products than how much they can afford or what the actual value is. And so we just consistently, since Ghost launch, we doubled pricing just about every 18 months as a test. And we'd see. We can afford for the conversion rate to go down by 50% when you double pricing, right? You make the same amount. And we found usually conversion would dip by maybe 20%. So the end result was we would have to support fewer customers.
More quality customer.
More high quality of customer with higher revenue. So we went from 5 to 10 to 19 to 29, and our monthly pricing is now 36. I think it's in a pretty sweet spot now. Kind of feels like it's the right balance for entry level.
But worth a try just to up it to see how much the drop off goes.
Yeah, so we did try a minimum price of $99.
Yes.
And
on the entry level.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it converted fine. It was absolutely fine, but it hit the point where that would be then three times less customers coming in than we have now. And it felt like each individual customer was proportionally too much. So losing one customer was like a really big deal.
Understood.
Versus losing one customer being not that much of an impact on actual recurring revenue. So 29 with starting point feels like a better.
So 29 for 12 months, 36 for 1 month.
Yeah. And what we find now at this price point is people pay more. They spend more time trying to get to know the product. They have more faith in the product. They trust it more. They're more patient. They're more understanding. They're more respectful when they contact support. And all in all, higher priced products I would always recommend if you're making something, double the price.
I mean, that's a massive takeaway. Just double the price and see what happens.
See what happens. There's a great, oh my goodness, I'm going to forget his name, but you'll have to look this up for me later. A Smart Bear is his Twitter name. Yeah, he started WP Engine.
Yeah, that's Jason Cohen.
So there's a great Jason Cohen talk. I think it's at MicroConf where he talks about the economics of SaaS pricing.
Yeah.
And he says this exact thing, you know, double your pricing, see what happens. And if conversion rate doesn't change, guess what? You're going to double it again.
Yeah.
And about how to reinvest marketing revenue into subscription dollars and so on and build that kind of wheel.
I mean, he's done his time, that guy.
Yeah, he really knows his stuff. He's got some very good talks and blog posts.
Where is WP Engine now on entry? I actually don't know.
35, I think.
Is it 35?
Yeah, very similar to us.
Now. Feels like the standard's there for a quality hosted platform.
Yeah, and what's funny is you... you get different expectations at different markets and products, right? So there's a lot of email tools which cost $29 a month starting. All they do is send email. In fact, usually all they do is a glorified UI on top of Mailgun, which actually, or SendGrid, which is what actually sends the email.
Yep.
And they do wildly successful. It's funny, the things people are and are not happy to pay for.
But you've got interface, CDN, security.
Sure, and we still get told, you know, we're too expensive, and I can fire up a WordPress install for $2.99 on a shared HostGator, GoDaddy account or something. And we're like, cool, yeah, if that's what you want to do, you should go do that.
Do you have any users on the open source platform moving over to the hosted platform like after 6 months or so?
Yeah, all the time.
Really?
That's one of our biggest areas of growth, probably.
Why do you think that is?
So a lot of people will start out... on the self-hosted open source products, they'll get to know it, they'll get invested, they'll enjoy the products and they'll like using it. And it's validated as useful to them and something they want to continue to use, but they get tired of the maintenance. After the server goes down once or twice, or we ship a lot of updates, they get tired of doing updates, or they realize they didn't have a backup, or their mail stops working, or they have an influx from Hacker News and they didn't have caching set up. And then their CPU usage goes up and they get billed crazy. They go, I like the product. I don't want to deal with hosting it, because they've realized most of the time they're a developer. Their time is worth X per hour and they are spending more than that on trying to keep their blog online or their publication online. And it makes a lot more sense to fund the open source project, which is maintaining the products, whilst at the same time getting free hosting.
Got a question here from Riley.
Hey, John. This is Riley from New York. I'm a 16-year-old with many different online and offline side hustles, one of which is making websites for local businesses. I used Ghost for one of them for a local DJ, and it works great, so thank you. But anyway, my question is, now that Ghost is widely known and pretty well established, have you considered not open sourcing future versions and instead dedicating 100% of the company towards bettering Ghost Pro? Cheers.
That's a good question. Ghost Pro is a fairly sophisticated platform as a service. It's a hosting orchestration layer that manages thousands of Ghost instances. And in some ways, it's very specific to Ghost. In other ways, it would be a very powerful platform for hosting any kind of app. So improving Ghost Pro by itself wouldn't necessarily result in more sales or attention for Ghost, the products, or do very much for us. I mean, we could do things like add more kind of continuous integration, deployment features, backups, site cloning, kind of stuff like WP Engine and Flywheel have got. But at that point, that's really kind of competing against on the hosting side. It's saying host with us, but you could also host elsewhere. And what we're competing on is hosting, and our differentiation is the hosting, which is not necessarily where we want to be playing. The interesting place for us to kind of innovate or try and do stuff is in the product space, where the choice is not whether you host Ghost on DigitalOcean or Ghost Pro. The choice is whether you go and use Squarespace or WordPress versus using Ghost. And if proportionally we have more people using Ghost and a percentage of them use Ghost Pro, we still have a larger market share. We still have more customers coming in. But what we get known for and what people talk about is Ghost versus other products and what Ghost does different to other products versus marketing within our existing user base of where to host it. So majority of our focus is around Ghost as opposed to just the hosting service. In terms of whether we would do some closed source stuff as well, maybe. So there's an interesting model WordPress tried, but we're not very successful at in terms of PR, which was Jetpack, right? And Jetpack is actually a really, really good idea. So for anyone who doesn't know, Jetpack is a series of services which are hosted on WordPress.com by Automattic. And it's you connect to any WordPress site using a plugin. Plugin's called Jetpack, obviously. And it does stuff like additional features, spam protection, backups, security. It does all kinds of really interesting stuff. It also does some like very poorly considered stuff, which is why it's earned a pretty bad reputation in the WordPress industry. And the way Automattic manage it is not ideal. So it feels to me Jetpack has always seemed like one of the best ideas that was never made it to where it could have been. But the idea of providing kind of API-based services to decentralized Ghost sites is an interesting one that we've thought about, and that by virtue would probably be in some part closed source.
Yeah.
But at the moment, team's still small. We always have to try and keep our focus. There's a lot of things we'd love to do, but we have to prioritize.
So Ghost and WordPress, you know, they aren't really competitors. You know, WordPress is now playing in this Wix Squarespace space. Would you say Medium is your biggest competitor right now?
Who is our biggest competitor? It's an interesting question. So there's the obvious ones, WordPress, Medium, Squarespace. There's kind of the, you know, what would I choose if I was going to set up a general small website, which we can fall into. There's the more kind of developer side of things. So there's a few platforms from kind of Express.js based things to more detailed frameworks that people build on top of. Which is more of a kind of developer choice for startups. There's a few different markets, from publishers to developers to marketing teams, and they all have their own sets of products that they prefer. The competition we're probably most interested in is Patreon.
Interesting.
Because while publishing is pretty well established, the problem which we're most interested in is trying to solve business models for journalism and for media. And what we have currently is a world in which fake news exists everywhere. And the reason fake news exists is because throughout the last few decades, media companies have done nothing but hemorrhage money as all of the advertising dollars in the world have slowly transitioned to Facebook and Google. At first slowly, then at a rate of knots. And now their revenue has more than halved. Layoffs are never ending. And they are clawing for the last bits of revenue they can get. And when your revenue is tied to clicks, the thing that happens is clickbait. And clickbait produces news that is not factually accurate. It is simply aimed at getting as many clicks as you can. So fake news should be a surprise to nobody. It is entirely economically aligned with the business model of news currently. And it's the dying grasp of an ad industry that has fallen out of favor and that is trying to survive. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in member-funded publications. Stratechery is a really good example in the tech space. The Correspondent's a really good example in Holland and now in the US of having media organizations which are funded by their members on a subscription basis, where the economic incentive is produce content which is actually valuable to readers, because the only way you make money is if the readers feel that what they're getting is of value, not advertisers. And so it's a really interesting idea. It's working very well in a few cases. It's growing quite fast. There's a lot of people talking about it. Patreon's doing quite well in the overall creator space. And there's a few smaller sites like The Information, Stratechery, Charged by Owen, which are doing well. And there's no good platform for it. There's certainly no self-hosted open source platform that does it really well. And so that's where we're kind of making our next big product leaps, is trying to solve that problem.
So, I mean, if Ev stood down a Medium, okay, it's a current shit show, and they said, we'll trade for the Ghost Foundation, we'll deposit $10 million.
Yeah.
But we need John to step in for 6 months, pull you out of Ghost.
Yeah.
But you can keep this funding, okay? No strings attached, no ownership, okay? What's the first order of business at Medium?
To fix Medium?
Yep.
Wow, this is weird. Like, solve my competitors' problems. Get rid of all the pop-ups.
Fuck, it's dark, yeah.
It's bad. It's terrible. We'll just cut this whole question out.
It's so staying in. I mean, this was my question before, but I really like Subtle from Dustin Curtis. You know, I really liked when he launched that. You know, it felt, I don't want to say ahead of its time, it's just like kind of what was needed.
Yeah.
But he had a weird, not a weird model, but it's $6 a month.
Yeah.
No freemium, just a you know, week trial.
Yeah.
Why do you think that didn't work out?
So Subtle and Medium and Ghost all kind of launched around the same time, 2012-13. And it felt like there was this mini renaissance of blogging of, hey, we need some new platforms that do publishing, and here are three different ideas.
They were all, you know, with great design as well.
Yeah. Which was, I think, also related to WordPress's design was really falling apart by that point and getting more and more bloated and cluttered, which helped.
Giving users too much control.
Subtle, I think, was the earliest, I would argue, of that little wave. Dustin is a great designer, also notoriously restless. I think he got bored of Subtle or couldn't figure out what to do with it in time for his own kind of, I don't know, creativity barrier to catch up to him. Then Medium kind of took off and overtook on that kind of centralized network-ish long-form reading experience. So that was an interesting idea. I think the business model was just thrown on at the end to try and make it sustainable after it failed to kind of be the leader in the mainstream adoption.
It felt like it needed to, you know, target a niche somehow, you know, instead of trying to target everyone. And then Medium came and it was free and beautiful. And
so my thing is, as soon as any product or company announces a manifesto, it's dead.
Wow.
If your point of differentiation is, we have a manifesto, and the manifesto is like, oh, we're never going to shut down, then
true story, yeah,
you've lost.
I think it's in maintenance mode now.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's officially.
I think you can still sign up though.
Yeah, I think you can. But manifestos, by and large, tend to be attached to companies which don't stick around for long, because if that's what you're focusing on differentiating, you're probably not focusing on the things you should be.
Okay, so this next section, it's a new one. You test dummy.
Ooh.
It's called no context.
I feel like a guinea pig.
And I'm just going to give you two words.
Yeah.
And you got to choose either of them.
I love it.
Rock and roll or chilled lounge?
Rock and roll.
Tarantino or Spielberg?
Tarantino.
Underwater or up in the air?
Underwater.
Rage Against the Machine or Nirvana?
Rage.
React or Ruby on Rails?
React.
Mohawks or ponytails?
Mohawks.
Open source software or recurring revenue?
Ooh, recurring revenue.
Medium or WordPress?
WordPress.
Kindle or hardcover?
Kindle.
Leonardo DiCaprio or Brad Pitt?
Brad Pitt.
So we got to use a question here from a Mark P. When traveling to Thailand, are you often confused with Leo from the beach?
Yeah, so Mark's got a running gag that I look like Leonardo DiCaprio from the beach. And that sounds good when you first hear it, until he starts sending you the pictures of Leonardo DiCaprio that he means, which is like Leonardo DiCaprio at his absolute fattest and most homeless looking. I'm like, oh, okay, thanks. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, pal. Oh,
cheers, mate.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've seen on YouTube, you started to vlog about Indo, Thailand, Seychelles, Canada, and even Norway a bit. Okay, what's next on your bucket list to visit?
Ooh, quite a few. So I have a long-term dream of buying a catamaran and living on that, and then circumnavigating the earth.
That's why you're sailing now.
Yeah, so I'm been doing some sailing courses currently to kind of get the official qualifications. And the dream is to get some multiple forms of internet on the back of a catamaran, sail it around the world, working and scuba diving and kite surfing wherever. So there's some
kind of just dock it.
Yeah, well, anchor or whatever. And then so there's some bucket list kind of sail to places, South Pacific, Fiji, Marquesas, all those places all around the...
That's a realistic dream.
Oh yeah, I'm actively working on it. It's gonna take a while, but yeah.
Is it about savings, or is it just the qualification? And
no, it's mainly about saving to buy the huge expensive 45-foot boat. Yeah, I think most of my travel bucket list destinations are now ocean based rather than land based. Beautiful.
So I mean, I've seen you dabble on YouTube a bit, and you know, you vlog about these locations, but the video with the most views you've got is an opinion on a lens.
Yeah, it's sad, isn't it?
And I just want your general take on YouTube at the moment. You know, is it worth the return on investment? Like your edits are good.
YouTube's a funny game. I like it. So I started making videos 2017, I think. And did, I don't know, 12, 14, something like that. And then burned out on the amount of time it takes on the edits, which you're no stranger to. The platform, I think, has amazing potential. I don't think it's saturated yet. I think it's a very interesting place to be. The amount of work required is incredible. I would do between 30 and 40 hours on a 7-8 minute video. And that's, you know, every single evening and weekend for one video a week. And that's reasonably proficient with doing edits.
It almost feels like you can justify those hours through preserving a memory.
Yes. Yeah.
But other than that, you know, like from a business model point of view, to throw onto YouTube, absolutely.
It's crazy.
No ways.
Yeah.
So do you feel that, you know, there's a future? I mean, video consumption is still massive.
Incredible.
It's,
yeah.
It's only getting bigger.
Yes.
Do you feel there's a space for video in Ghost?
Potentially. So YouTubers have a similar set of challenges with business models. A lot of YouTubers use Patreon. And so I have a feeling that some of the work we're doing around memberships and subscriptions could be interesting to YouTube creators. Particularly, there's continuous uproar around Patreon and their ethics and morals and the things they do and don't allow.
Yeah, it's been on fire at the moment.
Which is much less of an issue with open source platforms, where you own and control the technology as well as the content. Mm. You have the final say over what is allowed online and what isn't. So I think there's interesting opportunities there for video creators potentially to have a site with their own membership areas and their own, build their own communities, which is controlled by them, which they own, which they can control the destiny of, not just some centralized platform like Patreon, who can pull the plug at any time, as they quite clearly do.
Okay, dude, we're pretty warmed up. Would you agree with the statement? Journalists are essential for rightful democracy to happen.
Yes.
And do you feel that Ghost can play an important role for the future of democracy?
Yes, that's what gets me out of bed in the morning.
I mean, that's the crux of like everything you do.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. And in particular, kind of alluding to some of the what we touched on earlier, one of the most fundamental problems in journalism right now is it has no money. It has no funding. A lot of what previously funded real good journalism has dried up. And a lot of what we're left with is the dribs and drabs to try and pay payroll each month. And good journalism starts with funding. It starts with being able to pay an investigative journalist or any kind of journalist to cover something properly, not churn out 5, 10, 15 clickbait stories a day, but to actually go somewhere and investigate something and figure out what news is relevant to a community. And that's what journalism is fundamentally for. It's to educate and inform a community to be able to make better decisions about their day-to-day lives, whether that's what to buy, who to vote for, what's happening around them, and what's going on that would better inform them to be able to do anything. And a lot of journalism currently doesn't do that. And I think with better business models that really connects media back to the communities they're supposed to serve on a smaller scale, more niche scale, it's possible to get back to better journalism. And my hope is that creating an open source answer to the business model problem of journalism will really help move that forward.
So you mentioned in the past that the 10-year goal of Ghost is to have the best journalists in the world using Ghost.
Yeah.
Okay, so have you started headhunting them already and offering them the platform for free, even the hosted version?
Not as much as I'd like. We do outreach to people who we want to have on the platform. We're probably still a little early in terms of having answers to some of those big problems that would attract those types of people, but it's still very much the same goal.
Hey, it's Rob from The Edit. Thanks so much for all the encouragement after Yo episode 1, but I'm still learning, so please keep sending ideas and feedback to yo@robhope.com. What's hilarious is this next section was written a week before the recording, and John actually mentions the concept of my first idea twice during the show. I was just melting, trying to think of how to adapt, but just said it and left it in the show for laughs. Okay, back to it.
Okay, I got three product ideas for Ghost. I want to know which are rubbish.
Nice.
A white label platform by Ghost where an independent journalist signs up and creates a patron style model for their following where subscribers get exclusive content and they get paid.
Literally working on it right now, yeah. Beautiful. You're ahead of your time.
Okay, assuming that great journalists read a ton of articles.
Yeah.
A Rotten Tomato style site,
yeah,
where the articles are aggregated by other top journalists.
Oh, I like that. There's a couple of crypto startups that have, well, the names are escaping me now, that have a similar model. One dream I have one day is to create a decentralized, probably ActivityPub powered version of the Medium network, but without being a single centralized social network, but to have, you know, multiple interconnected nodes or ghost instances, yeah, or potentially even non-ghost instances, able to create that feed, that interesting source of new stories by people you want to follow without being all controlled by a single organization, but one day.
So then last one, just a richer publishing platform for journalists that includes some sort of fact checker in the dashboard, a story plotter, just like a richer research and publishing interface.
Yeah, rich research and publishing interfaces.
Do they exist?
There's a couple.
Okay.
Vox Media in particular have some clever things in their platform, which is called Chorus. They tend to be very specific and very niche, so it's very difficult to build one which serves the majority of people. So if you build one for a sports site which has Getty Images integrations, where you start typing the name of an NBA player and it automatically starts loading pictures of them in the latest match in a sidebar, and you can drag an image in, super incredibly useful.
Beautiful.
To a sports media outlet, pretty useless to everyone else.
Yeah.
And so weighing the economics of feature development is tricky. And we also have to consider how much confusion you might be adding by adding features which the majority of people will not use. So even if that would be really useful to a minority of users, it may confuse the majority of users, and that would be a net loss if,
yes,
the overall experience is then degraded. So it's always a balancing act of trying to figure out which features will be the most useful to the most users.
So second last question. So you got a team of 13. What decides the very next thing you need to work on?
So we do 6-week, 2-week cycles, which is used by quite a lot of companies these days. So we do 6 weeks of product development, and then 2 weeks of kind of bug fixing, clean up, more random open-ended work. The cycles, 6-week cycles, are usually decided or led by Hannah and I, in terms of Hannah, my co-founder, CTO, in terms of overall objectives, what we'd like to accomplish, and then what actual things get shipped. It's usually up to the team.
Yeah.
I'd say we're pretty strongly, probably 80% internally driven, in terms of we'll work on our own ideas and prioritize our own things we want to work on, and 20% filtering in suggestions and ideas from the community. There's an unlimited number of ideas and improvements and feature requests that come in constantly.
I can imagine.
But we bias far more heavily towards wanting to create a product that we love and then seeing if people like it, versus trying to please everyone by just saying yes to every single feature request.
When you have handpicked your team of 13 and you all share the same sort of values and morals, and you all, you know, see this future of, you know, journalism and Ghost in the same sentence, how do you prevent an echo chamber happening when you've just handpicked your whole team and everyone speaks the same?
Yeah, stuff? that's a really interesting one. So we've got a fairly diverse team in lots of ways. Diversity to me, rather than being any one particular attribute a person might have, it's more about background. So probably the way in which we're the most diverse is in physical geographic location and nationality. Languages spoken. So we already have a team spread across, I don't know what it is at the moment, I think 6 countries, 9 languages, all kinds of different backgrounds, several people who travel full time. So by virtue of that, everyone is already having different experiences in very different places, different cultures, different people they're interacting with, different stages in their life a lot of time, different communities they're surrounded by. So a remote team is already fairly more globally aware, for want of a better phrase that doesn't sound terrible, than I think a team holed up in an office in San Francisco. Yeah,
they all bring in their own cultures and history and background.
Yeah.
And not everyone's from London, just...
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And outside of that, I spend a lot of my time, what I try and focus on with my time is making sure that I'm always aware of the whole market, of the whole industry, and filtering that information, or at least the key parts of that information, back into the team. So we have a couple of Slack channels where I'll share mostly what the industry is doing, what's happening in journalism, what's happening in news, what's happening in technology space, which might affect us.
Yeah.
Occasionally what competitors are doing that might be relevant to us. We also publish a newsletter that actually looks at the wider industry of what's going on at the intersection.
Is that internal?
No, it's public.
That's the Publisher Weekly.
Yeah, Publisher
Weekly. I'm enjoying it. Yeah.
So we started that with a view to finding some of the early people who might be interested in the new member subscriptions features that we're working on.
Smart.
And at the same time, educating ourselves about what else is happening in that same space. And that's really useful contextual information to filter back into the team, to have this continuing awareness, to make sure we're not in a bubble, like you say.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that, you know, being a remote team that's fairly active and moving and traveling is a very healthy place to prevent echo chamber?
I think so. It's not to say it's not without problems.
Yeah,
I always
feel
the need to highlight that because it's always so easy to talk about what's great about remote teams. There's also downsides. Like it's much easier, I think, in a physical office to come up with an idea, sketch something, quickly prototype something, talk to someone else, get some feedback, and iterate on it really fast. And a remote team, inventing stuff is much slower, much more difficult. You're working across time zones. There's communication issues, whether it's text, which has less context, or video, which needs more bandwidth, scheduling, like all those things are much harder. The range of perspectives and input is probably a big benefit that comes very, very naturally. And at the same time, there's other challenges that have to be juggled to make that work.
You guys aren't following John already. He's John O'Nolan on Twitter.
Indeed.
I think your blog is john.onolan.org.
That's right.
But he doesn't blog that much, ironically.
No, I know. But that's about to restart. So what's going on in my life? I'm about to launch a new site.
A new blog?
It's going to be a new blog. It's going to be...
On WordPress?
It's going to be paid. It's going to be on Ghost. It's going to be site number one of Ghost's new members and subscription platform. So it will be paid only, with a focus on remote work, essentially travel remote work, and behind the scenes look at how I do all of that, and stories and insights into how all of that works. Basically what I've been doing for the last 8.5 years.
What a perfect way to test the platform.
That's what I'm saying.
Cool, man. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's a wrap for the second episode of the Yo Podcast. All I can ask, if you got value from the show or even had a laugh, is just tell a friend. This episode's outro track is a feel-good number by Jules Geyer called Glitz at the Ritz. I hope it gets you into gear for an epic day at work. Take care, and I'll chat to you in the next one. Me again. Just like episode one, if you're still listening, you are referred to as my people. So if you haven't already, email me at the secret address mypeople@robhope.com, and I want to send you something small. Thanks for listening.